to the Beef Watch Podcast. I'm Aaron Berger, a Nebraska Extension educator. For today's Beef Watch Podcast, we're going to discuss the topic of the influence of protein on reproductive performance of beef females. To have a conversation about this, I'm joined today by Dr. Sandy Johnson, who's an extension specialist at Kansas State University, focused on reproductive physiology and cow-calf management. Thanks for joining me today.
Happy to be here.
Dr. Johnson, you're part of a team of a number of faculty from different universities in the United States, an interdisciplinary team, who together make up the Beef Reproduction Task Force. You work together to put together an annual conference. Actually, that conference is titled the Applied Reproductive Strategies in Beef Cattle Conference. It'll be held this year in September 4th and 5th in Athens, Georgia. You have a really nice website that has the proceedings from past conferences. Also, annually, your group gets together and reviews and approves different ester synchronization protocols. Another resource that you have there at the beefrepro.org website is annually, you have a number of topics focused on beef reproduction on which you and other members do webinars. One of those webinars you recently did was back in February, actually on the topic we're going to discuss today. And so I thought, if you wouldn't mind, just share with us some of the content you shared in the webinar. I think is really timely, especially for the season we're in as we think about the upcoming breeding season.
You bet. You know, over the years, there's a lot of wheat in Kansas at places. And so Sandy sees anything green and lush and wants to graze it. And sometimes that works better than others, but I've always been interested in how some of the dairy data fits with some of our beef production systems. And so, it's been a number of years ago, but as the dairy industry was trying to meet nutrient requirements of these high producing dairy cows, they got into some pretty high protein diets. And what they found was they had some reductions in fertility when they did that. There were a number of studies looking at mechanisms and how high was too high. And the conclusion really on the dairy side is, you know, they are cognizant of not using too high a level of protein in their diets. And as we look at, you know, whenever the dairy industry has data that we don't have on the beef side, you know, it makes good sense to say, well, maybe that's why we see X, Y, or Z in the beef side. And so you would hear anecdotal reports of lower fertility of heifers or something bred off of wheat pasture. Now, the trouble is you never really knew everything you wanted to know about whether or not was there much out there for them to graze? You know, were they going backward in condition? You know, what was really going on? Were there other things impacting fertility? So when I can figure out ways to look at some of those issues, I have. And so a number of years ago, with our cow herd at Hayes, our range scientist was looking at some different grazing systems, and we actually bred some cows on either native pasture or wheat pasture. And in that wheat pasture, they would have started grazing about 30 days prior to breeding, you know, just kind of depending on the year. And in that particular study, we didn't see any significant differences between the native range or the wheat pasture cows. And that was, we had data over 5 years, and I think we had, you know, 70, 80 cows per year. So a pretty good test of that.
Sandy, tell us the time of year those cows were being bred on wheat pasture. Was this mid-May to early June timeframe, or what was the time frame? And then just also thinking about the stage of maturity of that wheat pasture.
Right. So when we were breeding cows in Hayes, typically would have been kind of, I think we bred those each year early June. And so depending on, you know, when that wheat was big enough to graze, they may have gone on late April, but would typically be May. And then, yeah, just depending on the year, the maturity of that would vary. We would typically harvest wheat in that area around the 1st of July. And we did always provide some additional dry forage out there so that if the water content was so high, they had some dry forage to try and slow down that rate of passage.
And that study, you had a set of cows, basically same genetics, same breeding season, same setup, one on native grass, the other on wheat pasture, and over 5 years saw no difference in the reproductive performance between those two groups.
Right, right. They're, you know, numerically higher on the native, but again, not statistically different. And we do the statistics for a reason. And so, yeah, that's what we saw on that occasion.
So you also did some additional research looking at a study on heifers and saw a little different results in that situation.
Right. You know, as we've tried to incorporate some of our cover crops into some of our livestock systems, what works well in Western Kansas when we have enough moisture to grow it is a monoculture such as triticale as our quote unquote cover crop. And, you know, when we have enough moisture, it's a tremendous resource that can come in this spring period prior to breeding season, give us a little more time before we get on native pasture. And so I had a cooperating producer that I worked with for a number of years. We actually bred heifers then either in a dry lot setting or on triticale. They would have wintered together, then they might have grazed a variety of things from dry grass to volunteer wheat. But, you know, a month or so prior to the start of the breeding season, we'd separate those, half of them in the dry lot, half of them would go on triticale, and synchronized and AI'd those females. As we look at those rations or what they were eating, of course, the growth varied over those years. First year, the protein in the triticale was actually higher at the time of breeding, was also more mature, but part of that was we had a lot of moisture, didn't get as much grazing on that early as we would have liked. And so probably the nitrogen fertilizer we put on was benefiting the crude protein in that forage at the time of breeding. Other years, we were able to get on those fields a little bit sooner. Protein at the time of breeding would have ranged anywhere from about 13 to 18%. And so as it would happen, well, let me back up. Our dry lot rations then, we didn't try and, you know, match these diets necessarily. We wanted the heifers in the dry lot to gain as much as we thought they needed to based on, you know, where we were at. So the protein in those dry lot diets ranged anywhere from about 11 to 14%. And they were higher 1 year because we were further behind on those heifers and really had more dry distillers in that diet to get more energy. And that was the way to do it. So variation over the years, when we look at the difference in performance, the heifers out on triticale typically outperform those in the dry lot. And despite that improved performance and average daily gain and improvement in body condition, our AI pregnancy rates were lower overall in those triticale heifers. The first year when the forage was a little more mature, but the protein in the diet was higher, there was no difference that year. And so we're trying to blame this on high protein, but our protein in those diets seemed a little bit lower really in the years where we saw more difference in AI pregnancy rates. So a different result than what we had seen earlier with the cows that hit an AI pregnancy rate was statistically different. I'm not sure I can explain the differences between, you know, what happened with cows and what happened with the heifers. The, you know, challenging thing is that as we're doing this study at the producers, those heifers were watering on native pasture. So they always had access to that native pasture. So that's a, you know, a variable that we couldn't really control. As we look at some of the other studies that have been done that kind of try and get at the same question, we see a variation in responses, you know. So there's something going on. I'm not sure that strictly total protein in the diet is the issue. One of the things that I do know, if we look at cows, and oftentimes if they're a little thin coming out of calving, if we can put some body condition score on these cows that actually get them to cycle prior to breeding, even if we took some reduction in early pregnancy rates, getting that body condition score back on may be as valuable as they got to be cycling to conceive. So if they're not cycling and we don't have the feedstuffs to get them there, unless we put them on this less forage, you know, we're not going to have those early pregnancies either. So it's a challenging issue to deal with because you really appreciate the quality of the forage, but not sure if we always know how to manage it to optimize those pregnancy rates.
In the study that you mentioned on these heifers that were synchronized for a timed AI, what happened after those heifers were bred? Did they go back to their respective feed rations? So the dry lot heifers went back to the dry lot and the wheat pasture heifers went back out? Or what happened the 2-3 weeks after breeding?
Right. So the dry lot heifers, we tried to kind of wean them off of their dry lot diet where they were. We could begin to turn them out and still feed them a little in the dry lot and get them grazing. They had access along a creek, so there was, you know, it's a little more growth going there. We didn't want to have a big shift in their diet by immediately taking them somewhere else or a different diet. So we kind of tried to transition them. And then depending on, you know, the year and what forage was there, they may have gone back out with the other triticale group trying to utilize that. But we tried to ease that transition just from the standpoint of the dry lot heifers being ready to eat.
So there was some variability by year and by what happened after the timed AI in terms of the diet they were on the weeks following the timed AI. Is that correct?
Right. We tried to transition them off of there, but again, two diets were not comparable. And, you know, when I'm working with the producer, we're trying to minimize any negative impacts past what we're trying to test. And there would have been other questions to try and ask, you know, looking at effects before or after breeding, but, you know, we weren't really set up to do that in this situation.
So as you look at the literature review, as you think about your experiences with producers, what are some principles or things you would encourage folks to think through as they think about this potential issue? And then again, as you've well said, there's a lot of variation here. Sometimes you don't get the results you might expect. Other times you maybe have something happen you didn't expect. But as you look at the data, as you think about your experience, what are some principles to think through around plenum nutrition, grazing on annual forages during the spring as we think about the breeding season?
Yeah, so a couple things come to mind. One is this is a tremendous resource, you know. Can we utilize it in some fashion? And I'm in favor of trying to utilize that resource if we can. So if I was looking at a nice green lush field right now, I'd be thinking about how can I use that, transition them to something else prior to breeding maybe. And I'm not sure that we would have to be off of that for a long period of time. I think the impacts are likely more short term. And so can we take advantage of that? We got to keep in mind that we don't want a big change in energy in the diet if we're on this really lush diet and then turn them out onto native grass, it's not ready. We might expect some problems there. More so for, I think heifers are more sensitive than cows, perhaps, to that, to some of these shifts. So we tried to think about that timing. How can I use it? Can I make a transition to something else prior to breeding? If I need to use it, then I want to make sure that I'm offering some type of dry forage along with it. And that's just general good management practices from a rate of passage. As you know, that can be pretty lush stuff in the spring if there's plenty of moisture. So I'm in favor of trying to figure out a way to use it, but being cautious about having that real lush forage right in front of the breeding season.
As you looked at some of the data and other research, any principles from some of those studies that you think have application to this scenario as well?
You know, they have looked at a variety of supplementation and trying to, you know, provide more degradable protein or undegradable protein and kind of look at that in a very controlled way. And some of those studies are ones that showed no negative impact on reproduction. So while that seems like a logical direction to go right now, you know, I guess we could try and repeat those studies today, see if we still get those same responses. But the dry forage is what I would add. And then if we have lactating cows on less forage, we always need to think about our grass tetany issues and those type of things.
Well, anything else on this topic you'd highlight today?
Well, I wish I had more concrete answers for producers, but as I look at the situation, I think it's can be a good resource, but we need to utilize it carefully and understand how that might have some negative impacts right ahead of breeding and try and manage around that.
Well, thanks again for joining me today.
Very pleased to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, for more information on the topic we discussed in today's Beef Watch podcast, I would encourage you to visit beefrepro.org. As I mentioned earlier in our conversation, Dr. Johnson put together a nice webinar on this topic. The webinar is archived there, and you're welcome to go back and watch it at beefrepro.org.